I'm Amy Goodman. Stay tuned now for Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer.
Journalist, author, and activist Allison Weir is coming to Kansas City next week. Today on Tell Somebody, Katie Escobar, on staff with the organization If Americans Knew, will talk with us about If Americans Knew founder Allison Weir, Weir's upcoming visit here, and about Israeli-Palestinian-U.S. relations. Stand by for Tell Somebody. Welcome to Tell Somebody for February 25th, 2015. www.tellsomebody.us, on Twitter, at Tell Somebody Now, and look for Tell Somebody Now on Facebook and like it. And remember, you can subscribe to the podcast for free at the iTunes Store. This is your host, Tom Clammer. Big thanks to Jeff Humfeld, Mike Murphy, and all the great guests who filled in on the show for the last 3 weeks. And thanks to everyone who contributed to your community station during Tell Somebody in the first of those 3 weeks. If you missed out on that, you know you can contribute anytime, night or day, by clicking on a donate button at www.kkfi.org. And give Tell Somebody a plug in the comments box. Well, you've got a big decision to make next Thursday night, a live debate or a movie. Next Thursday, March 5th, 7 p.m. at the UMKC Student Union Theater at 5100 Cherry in Kansas City, Missouri, the Economics Club of UMKC, KC Move to Amend, and the Mainstream Coalition will present the film Pay to Play, Democracy's High Stakes. According to the Los Angeles Times, Pay to Play lays out a compelling case against corporate personhood and money as free speech, researched, sourced, and interviewed exhaustively. More information on that at www.kcmovetoamend.org. Also, next Thursday, March 5th, 7 to 9 p.m. at the Tomahawk Ridge Community Center, 11902 Lowell, Overland Park, Kansas, Citizens for Justice in the Middle East, and American Friends Service Committee, Kansas City, sponsor a debate, What Americans Need to Know About Israel, Two Perspectives. Two prominent speakers and writers, Allison Weir from the United States and Dr. Anat Maor from Israel, will offer contrasting perspectives, and there will be a Q&A period after the speakers' presentations. More information on that event and a couple of others at www.cjme.org, and be ready for a repeat of Allison Weir event information at the end of the show. Have a pencil ready. The plan was to have a conversation with Allison Weir to air this morning, but due to a bout of laryngitis, she had to cancel. So what I'm going to do is air just a little bit of audio from a talk Allison Weir gave in Seattle last summer, and then we'll have a conversation with Katie Escobar, on staff with If Americans Knew, a national organization that provides information on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and this organization was founded by Allison Weir. Allison Weir is a prominent national speaker and author of many articles on Israel, Palestine, and U.S. policy in the Middle East, and of the recently published book, Against Our Better Judgment, How the U.S. Was Used to Create Israel. Allison Weir, speaking last summer. Give a listen.
I think as Americans, sometimes we're sort of used to seeing images of third world poverty. I think we're troubled by them, but we tend to think, well, there's so much, what can I do? But that's not what I was seeing. I was seeing intentionally created poverty through the use of American money. And I saw much more. I don't like seeing suffering. I don't like seeing children in pain. But since even by that time, thousands of children had been injured through the use of my tax money, it was my job to see them. And all I had to do, it turned out, was go to the nearest hospital. And I saw children with bullets in their back, often in their back, because they were running away, and in their stomach, and in their heads. I saw a brain-dead 12-year-old. I saw children who will never walk again. They won't skip. They won't frolic. Their childhoods are finished. At one point, I saw a child. I saw his parents. And they asked if I could help them. They were happy to see me as an American because they thought maybe I could help their poor son. So I asked the doctor if maybe I could do something. Maybe a surgical team could be flown in from the U.S., or maybe their son could be flown back to the United States. Sometimes that's possible. And the doctor explained to me that he hadn't yet had the right, found the right time and the right way to tell the parents, but that their son was totally and eternally paralyzed. So I knew something they didn't know, and I wished that I didn't. And now you do too. And when I came back from that first trip, I started an organization called If Americans Knew, because I believed, and I still believe, if we all knew what was going on, we would stop funding it and we would end the violence. We especially looked at the media, because the media, I feel, news organizations, this is the most powerful institution in a democracy. This is how everybody around us learns what they think they know about many issues, especially international issues. So we decided to conduct media studies. I like the idea of a statistical study where you choose a category of significance, something as that is as immune to subjective bias as possible. We decided to study how the media covered deaths among both populations. Both is the key word. We rarely get that. And we especially decided to look at the first year of that current uprising, because first impressions are so powerful. And we did a subcategory of how many children were killed and how those were covered, because I believe pretty much all of us feel that it is horrible and tragic when a child is killed. We're deeply saddened. It's also extremely newsworthy. So we needed to ask, to answer a very sad question: how many children among both populations were killed in that first year? Using an Israeli source, we discovered 28 Israeli children had been killed and 131 Palestinian children. How was this covered by our primetime network news shows, CBS, ABC, NBC? Well, we found that they had covered Israeli children's deaths at rates up to 13 and 14 times greater than they reported on the Palestinian children's deaths. In fact, typically, the media have a pattern of reporting on Palestinian children's deaths so minimally, even though they are so large, that many people have no idea they've been occurring. Another group did a study of National Public Radio. NPR has been accused consistently by Israel partisans as being supposedly pro-Palestinian. They have caused substantial financial damage to some NPR affiliates around the country with that accusation. So Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting decided to look into those accusations and to study NPR's reporting. Their researcher, Seth Ackerman, did an excellent study, and he discovered that, yes, indeed, NPR is very distorted on this issue, but that once again it is in a pro-Israel direction.
Katie Escobar is the social media director and outreach coordinator at If Americans Knew, a research and information dissemination institute that focuses on Israel-Palestine. She was the co-chair of Students for Justice in Palestine at the University of California, Irvine, where she graduated from in 2011. Katie Escobar, welcome to Tell Somebody.
Thank you so much, Tom. Glad to be here.
Appreciate you taking the time. An organization called If Americans Knew. Tell me about this organization and If Americans Knew what, and why do we need an organization for this? We have media, we have government press releases. Talk about that a little bit.
Sure, Tom. So If Americans Knew is an independent research and information dissemination institute that has the goal of reaching Americans on the issue of Israel-Palestine and providing them with information that is, to a large degree, missing from American press coverage of the region. I'm sure some of your listeners might be aware that much of the mainstream media has a very Israel-centric focus. So when things happen to Israelis, newspapers report on it, but unfortunately when things happen to Palestinians, we don't really hear about it. And this sort of gives the Americans the impression that the toll of the conflict is harming Israelis much more than Palestinians. Now, obviously, both people on both sides of the population are affected by this conflict, but Americans just don't really know that Palestinians are impacted far worse, especially being the fact that they are the ones living under an Israeli occupation that has been going on for over 45 years. So If Americans Knew was founded about 14, 15 years ago. Allison Weir, who's an author and journalist, traveled to the region as an independent journalist and to see what was happening for herself. What she found was vastly different than what was reported in the American media. And she was so shocked by what was going on that she decided to create the organization with the hopes of getting this information out to Americans. So most of what we do is basically just giving people the facts about what's happening. And sadly, that's largely missing from mainstream media coverage, which makes what we do so important. And there are lots of other organizations that are working on this issue as well. Fairness and accuracy in reporting doesn't solely focus on Israel-Palestine. They focus on media bias in general among a number of issues, but they do great work. Times Warp covers this issue where they look at the way that the New York Times portrays the conflict. So there are a lot of organizations working on this, but we try to specifically focus on what is missing from American media coverage and get that information out to Americans so they can be aware of how what's going on and also how the United States is the group that's funding this. We want Americans to know what's going on, but we also want them to know that the United States is giving Israel over $3 billion a year.
Can you repeat that figure again?
So the United States gives Israel $3.1 billion per year in direct military aid. That's roughly $8.5 million per day. And when you include monies for defense, well, they're so-called joint defense programs, but they largely benefit Israeli defense, such as the Iron Dome, David's Arrow. If you include those defense programs, we give Israel close to $10 million a day.
Iron Dome and what was it, David's Arrow?
Yeah, so there's a number of programs that are called anti-missile programs. So the goal of those projects is to prevent Palestinian rockets from reaching into Israel. So they have millions more dollars going to this technology trying to prevent, you know, anything from hitting inside of Israel. Now, at the same time, you know, Israel is sending missiles and bombs into Gaza, and that we don't give Palestinians any military aid to defend against what Israel's doing to them. So all of the aid that we give to Palestinians, about $400 million is humanitarian aid. But what we give to Israel, the $3 billion in military aid, is used to manufacture weapons to injure and kill Palestinians. which is why we Americans have the right to know about it.
What I seem to remember just casually listening to news when there's something more intense than usual going on over there is that Israel has the right to defend itself, and they have to do this because the Palestinians are lobbing all those rockets at them, and Palestinians, according to the Israeli politicians, are using their population as human shields, so they have no choice but to retaliate, and they regret collateral damage, but it can't be helped. What's your response to that?
Sure. So, well, for starters, the population of Palestine is divided into Gaza and the West Bank, which are two very tiny pieces of land on either side of Israel. So when you're looking at the Gaza Strip and the attacks that Israel has done to the Gaza Strip, there's very little room for the people within Gaza to move. So when they talk about human shields in Gaza, you have to understand that there is really nowhere for these people to go. They are also, their borders are strictly controlled by Israel, the land, air, and sea. So they can't leave. They're also, it's a highly urban environment. So there's really nowhere for them to go. And so when, during the assault on Gaza last year, where Israel killed over 2,100 Palestinians in Gaza, there were people taking shelter in schools, in mosques, anywhere they could find. And for Israel to characterize that as, you know, Hamas creating human shields is just false. It's not true. And as far as the self-defense question, it's very hypocritical to say that only one side of a certain population or one side of a conflict has the right to defend itself. Because if we're going to talk about self-defense, we would obviously have to look at the Palestinians' right to self-defense. And that's simply, that whole concept of Palestinians having the right to defend themselves, defend their families, defend their land, it's simply not present in the media discourse. So when you see Palestinians resisting Israeli bombings and resisting the Israeli occupation, it's looked at as terrorism. It's looked at as violence. But the violence that is visited upon Palestinians on a daily basis, and also in these horrific wars and assaults that Israel started, the only violence that's being focused on is the Palestinian response. So people really need to look at the power disparity between the two groups. Israel is a modern country. They have nuclear weapons. They have all kinds of military technology that's capable of, you know, destroying cities and killing thousands of people. The few Palestinian groups that are armed, the vast majority of Palestinians do respond with nonviolent means, whether it's with hunger strikes, with nonviolent demonstrations. But the few Palestinian groups that do respond with, you know, weapons and with armed resistance, they have rockets. You know, they have these sort of rockets that have killed, sadly, have killed Israelis, but in comparison to how many Palestinians Israel has killed, the number is far fewer. I mean, the ratio is really, it's astronomical. The number of Israelis killed by rockets from Gaza is, you know, around 30 people. Israel killed 2,100 Palestinians in the course of 5 weeks this last summer. If you were to look at how many Palestinians were killed in Gaza over the last few years, the number is much higher. So when we talk about self-defense, we can't just look at the Israeli side, because Israel has all these means to defend itself, and it uses them, but it abuses them, and the self-defense issue sort of wouldn't even be spoken about if there were justice for Palestinians who are living in their homeland and fighting for their rights. So there wouldn't be these wars, and there wouldn't be these attacks were Israel not occupying Palestinian land, were Israel not preventing Palestinians in Gaza from moving and preventing fishermen from providing for their own families by fishing in their own water. So there's this whole other host of issues that the media ignores when they solely decide to paint the conflict in terms of Israel's right to self-defense and it's the Palestinians' fault for sending rockets. And one more point on that subject. It's been demonstrated that the vast majority of the time, Hamas and other Palestinian armed groups have not been the ones that violated the ceasefire and started the violence. So in the vast majority of cases, it's been Israeli forces that have done a targeted assassination or killed Palestinians, which then prompted a response from Hamas. And this is all documented. But the media ignores these facts, and they always, as soon as a Palestinian sends a rocket, it makes the news. But what doesn't make the news is what happened before that rocket was sent. So that's sort of more media misinformation that American News working to combat.
Yeah, I couldn't find the original article or quotes, but I remember reading, I believe just after Obama was elected and maybe hadn't been inaugurated yet, in 2008, or maybe very early 2009, there was this heightened conflict in Israel-Palestine, and he was quoted as saying something about, you know, if he lived in Israel, he would be very concerned about his daughters being hit by one of these rockets from, quote-unquote, the bad guys. My paraphrase, not his quote, but...
Right.
Which is very understandable. If I was in Israel and had daughters, I'd be very concerned about that.
Right.
But there didn't seem to be any expression of the concern of Palestinian parents for their daughters.
Absolutely, Tom. And that sort of goes back to the media bias issue, is that, you know, President Obama expressing sentiments like that, but so many other celebrities and public figures have expressed similar sentiments, that they empathize with Israelis. They, you know, when Israelis are scared or when Israelis are harmed, they feel it, you know, deep down that this is wrong. And I can't believe if I had to go through something like this. But when it comes to what Palestinians are going through, the empathy to a large degree is just not there in the media, which is, it's so strange because Palestinians are the ones that have suffered the most from this conflict since 1948, since 1967 when Israel reoccupied the Gaza Strip in the West Bank. So, you know, there's just some of the most tragic and horrifying stories that are coming out of Palestine, and almost every family in the Palestinian territories has been affected. You know, everyone has lost someone. Everyone has had a family member that's been unjustly imprisoned, held without charge, people attacked by illegal Israeli settlers. So Palestinians are suffering very deeply as a result of the Israeli occupation and what's going on over there. And it's just the empathy for Palestinians is not there. They're portrayed as terrorists. People are told that the Palestinians teach their children to hate Jews. They're told that Palestinians are Muslim, so they don't respect their own women. I mean, there's so many different stereotypes out there, absolutely false, that also, you know, contribute to why Americans don't really have empathy for Palestinians. So President Obama's comments were sort of a symptom of that larger issue. And I think also people tend to empathize more with Israelis because we've been told that we have a special relationship with Israel, that they share our Judeo-Christian values, that they're a democracy just like us. In reality, most of those things are not really true. Israel is not a real democracy in the sense that most people would think of the word. There are actually a lot of laws in place in Israel that don't allow for equal rights among the Palestinian Arab population in comparison to the Jews. So people just don't really have a good understanding of what's really going on in the region. And unfortunately, that definitely results in the Palestinian people's suffering not being taken seriously. And not only that, not only not being taken seriously, but essentially being completely, either it's erased or it's just everyone's painted with the broad brush of being a violent terrorist. And we're hoping to contribute to changing that narrative and changing people's awareness of who's really suffering the most. And it's not about comparing suffering, saying, oh, they're suffering more and Israeli suffering doesn't matter. You know, anytime someone is killed or injured, it's wrong. It doesn't matter if they're Israeli or Palestinian. It's always wrong to kill innocent people. It's always wrong to kill children. It's always wrong to harass and to steal people's land. But the vast majority of this is being done to the Palestinians by Israelis, and people just aren't aware of that. And when they are aware, you know, they sort of start to change their view of the region, and they start to think about things more in terms of how can we have a just solution to this rather than, you know, let's just defend Israel at all costs, and let's just give Israel whatever it wants. Let's give it more weapons.
This is Tom Clammer. You're listening to Tell Somebody on 90.1 FM KKFI, talking to Katie Escobar with If Americans Knew. We need to take a short break, and we'll be right back after you listen to this.
What if we had more hard-hitting journalism, more local stories, more quality kids shows, more independent voices?
What if we had more people telling their friends about the vital information they hear on KKFI? What if we had more listeners supporting community radio in Kansas City and the surrounding area? Most of the nearly 2 million people our 100,000-watt transmitter can reach have never heard of us. What if more people helped us get more hard-hitting journalism and more local stories on the air on KKFI? What if more people realized the potential of KKFI and got involved in trying to reach that potential?
What if we had less celebrity fluff, less mind-numbing advertising, less partisan shouting, less junk TV? We need more public media, better public media, new public media, now.
This is David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and I want to invite you to tune in to Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now!, right here on KKFI.
Welcome back to Tell Somebody. This is Tom Clammer, and we're very happy to have Katie Escobar, the social media director and outreach coordinator at If Americans Knew!, a research and information dissemination institute that focuses on Israel-Palestine. And she is filling in for Allison Weir, who will be speaking in Kansas City on Thursday, March 5th. And if you want to have a pencil at the ready, we'll repeat all the information on that before the end of the show. Katie, you mentioned 1948. A few minutes ago, and some reference to the, I think, something to the effect of illegal occupation of Palestinian land. We could probably spend three or four whole shows diving deep into the history of what has become Israel and Palestine. And I think to understand it, we'd have to go at least back to World War I and Britain, I believe, causing many of our current problems all over the Middle East by drawing lines helter-skelter. But do you have something short and brief to say about that history that you think more Americans need to appreciate what's going on?
Absolutely. And kind of starting at the beginning there is a good way to get a better understanding of why the situation today is what it is. So when people talk about 1948, what they're referring to is the creation of the State of Israel. So, you know, in the early 40s, Israel was not a country. The region was governed by a protectorate. For a while, the Ottoman Empire had been in control of the land, then the British Empire. So during the early 1900s, before World War II, the land of Palestine, that small area that is now Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories, was inhabited by a multicultural population that was mostly Muslim. It was around 85% Muslim, 10% Christian, and about 4% Jewish. They were, for the most part, living in peace. They were neighbors. And the tension started to happen when political Zionism became a movement that saw the land in Palestine as a location to create a Jewish state for the Jewish people. Now, everyone is very aware of the persecution of Jews in Europe and around the world. In the late 1800s, a small group of Jewish people in Europe decided to pursue political Zionism. And what that was a movement that was looking to create a Jewish homeland for the Jewish people. So this would be a state that would be populated by Jews. The government would be Jewish. And this was to ensure their safety in the face of, you know, hostility against Jewish people worldwide. Everyone knows about the anti-Semitism that preceded, you know, what ended up happening in Nazi Germany and World War II and the Holocaust. So this movement, this political Zionist movement, looked in many different places for where they would be able to establish their homeland. They looked in South America, Africa. They decided on Palestine. So in the early 1900s, Jewish people started arriving in Palestine, mostly from Europe, and other Jewish people from other places around the world, including in the Arab world, as there were many Jews in the Arab world as well. They began immigrating to Palestine. And this wasn't a problem until their numbers started to increase to the point that there was sort of clashes with the local population, which were Palestinian Arabs. So Palestinian Arabs saw that what was happening was sort of that there were these ulterior motives to create a Jewish state, to acquire more of the land, to acquire the favor of the British, who were still in control of the land. And so in the 1920s and 30s, there were definitely clashes between the new Jewish immigrants and the local Palestinians who had been there for a long time. And some of this was exacerbated by the fact that in Palestine, much of the land was not privately owned in the typical way that, you know, we think about it today. You know, families had farmed on land for generations. The land was collectively owned. Benefited many people rather than, you know, privately owned. And then there's just, you know, this extreme class system of, you know, the very wealthy and the very poor, although, of course, there was economic disparity. But the point is that given that there was a lot of land that was collectively owned, when Jewish immigrants came and were buying up the land, it sort of changed the entire structure of the economy, and the indigenous Palestinian people were very resentful of that because they saw their land and resources sort of being taken away, and they got the feeling that they weren't, these new immigrants were not particularly friendly to them, that there were going to be problems. So by the end of World War II, the Jewish population had increased from around 5% to in the town of 30%. And at that point, they still only owned about 7% of the land in Palestine. But they were still vying to have their own state. So there was a lot of pressure from Zionists in Britain, Zionists in America, that were persuading the U.S. and Britain to convince the U.N. to create a Jewish state in Palestine, even though they were only 30% of the population, even though they only owned 7% of the land. And what ended up happening was the U.N. recommended a partition of the land. So they wanted to create a Jewish state next to an Arab state in order to sort of solve the problem of the clashes between the people in order to give the Jewish people the state that the Zionists had been pushing for. But the UN recommended giving 55% of the land to Palestine for the Jewish state and only 45% of the land to the Palestinians or the Arabs for a Palestinian state. So what ended up happening was Palestinians said, no, this isn't fair. This is our land. We're not going to just give over half of it to these people who are new and hostile to us. So what ended up happening was Israel fought what they call a war of independence, what Palestinians call the Nakba, and that means catastrophe in English. And the reason it's called the Nakba is because during this war, 250,000 Palestinians were expelled from their land, forced to leave their homes. And during that time, Israel confiscated enough land, far more than 55% of the land. They ended up confiscating 78% of the land. So by the time the War of Independence was over, all these Palestinians had been ethnically cleansed. They were not allowed to return because they weren't Jewish. The new Jewish state was on 78% of the land. Palestinians were left with the remaining 22%. And they were largely living in refugee camps because they didn't have homes anymore. The homes had been confiscated by Israel. There were hundreds of towns that were completely destroyed by Israel and rebuilt During this this so-called War of Independence, Israeli forces ended up destroying hundreds of Palestinian villages and towns. They ended up rebuilding their own towns on those ruins with Jewish names. The Arabic names were lost. So, you know, for a student of history, for someone that would look into this deeper, they would see that this was a war in which ethnic cleansing happened, because 700,000 Palestinians forced to leave their homes and lands. Once the battles were over and once the violence and hostilities were over, they were not allowed to return because they're not Jewish. And those refugees are actually still classified. Those refugees and their descendants today are still classified as refugees because under international law, you have to let people return once the violence is over. So Palestinians aren't allowed to live where their families before them lived for you know, dozens of generations and hundreds of years. And now there's about 5 million, nearly 5 million Palestinian refugees living in the West Bank and Gaza. Many more Palestinians ended up moving to the United States, to Europe. But they are still considered a refugee population whose rights are not being observed under international law. Now, after the State of Israel was established in 1948 through this war, for the years after, even after the State of Israel was established, Palestinians who had remained within Israel's borders, about 20% of the people in Israel were Palestinians that stayed and did not leave during the war, that were not expelled during the war. So Israel still had to contend with the fact that there were Palestinians living within the new Jewish state. But those Palestinians also were not granted full equal rights under the law, under the laws of Israel. I can give you a couple examples of what I mean by that. The educational systems within Israel for the Arab population versus the Jewish population are largely kept separate. They're unequal. Palestinian schools do not get as many resources as Israeli schools that are, you know, largely for Jewish students. Palestinian Israelis and Arab Israelis don't have access to the same sort of property. So in Israel, there's a fund called the Jewish National Fund, where the rest of the land of Israel is publicly held by the government. It is designated as land exclusively for the Jewish people, which means that Palestinian Israelis and Arab Israelis and Palestinians who had lived on those lands for centuries do not have access to that land. They are also not allowed to officially marry Jewish citizens. Israel has laws preventing Jewish citizens from marrying non-Jews. So there's all sorts of laws that in the United States, if these laws were to be in effect, it would be viewed as, you know, racial segregation, racial apartheid. But in Israel, because Israel is designated as a Jewish state, that's sort of what's going on, and they justify it by saying, well, we have to do it for self-preservation, but they're doing it at the expense of people who have lived there for hundreds of years. And just to sort of continue about the history of Israel, I referred to 1967 earlier. In 1967, so after the State of Israel was established, the Gaza Strip and the West Bank were controlled by outside countries. I believe it was Jordan and Egypt. But in 1967, there was yet another war where Israel began to militarily occupy Gaza and the West Bank. So in 1967, now all the rest of the Palestinians that were expelled during Israel's war for independence are now living under an Israeli military occupation. So the Israeli stranglehold on Palestinian lives affects every aspect of life, because the Palestinians living under the Israeli military occupation don't have the freedom of movement or the freedom to travel. They're subject to random arrests. They're subject to detentions. Any male age 18 or over is essentially viewed as someone that could be a terrorist or someone that, you know, could be a threat. I mean, even Palestinian teenagers have been imprisoned and young Palestinian boys. So their lives are affected by the occupation in every way. And this is still happening in 2015. And, you know, Americans are not really aware of the extent of the Israeli, the history of Israel's war of independence and then the resulting Israeli military occupation. Because when they hear about Israel-Palestine, they just think it's these terrorists attacking, you know, this brave, noble nation of Israel. When in reality, the Palestinians had their land taken from them. They were kicked out of their homes. They were not allowed to return. So there is a just cause in what Palestinians are fighting for and what they're asking for. And the vast majority of them are doing so by nonviolent means, by, the BDS movement, by nonviolent protests.
BDS, that's the boycott. What is it? Boycott, divest, and sanction?
Yeah, the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement is a movement that calls on companies and countries to divest or take out their resources from companies that are in Israel that are profiting from the occupation. So essentially, what Americans don't realize about Israel-Palestine when they read the news is that Palestinians are not, you know, simply just inflicting violence on Israelis for no reason. The few Palestinians that do respond with violence, and like I said, they're the minority. The vast majority of Palestinians have been resisting peacefully for decades. But what they're responding to is land theft. They're responding to the colonization of their land. They're responding to home demolitions perpetrated by Israeli forces that are done in attempts to confiscate even more Palestinian land. They're responding to the fact that they don't have freedom of movement to travel around in their own land. There are separate roads for Palestinians in the West Bank compared to the roads that they've created for the Israeli Jewish settlers. So there are all kinds of injustices happening that the mainstream media doesn't cover. So that's why it's so important to go back and really look at the history of how the situation today got to where it is. So the violence that's happening is not happening in a vacuum. Israel is continuing to dominate the Palestinians, and many people think ultimately make life so miserable for them that they'll stop fighting back, that they'll stop trying to stand up for their rights, and that they'll just leave, and that, you know, more of them will emigrate to the United States or to Europe or to surrounding Arab countries like Jordan. So that's really important for people to understand the history behind the conflict before they make statements such as, oh, Israel's just defending itself, or the Palestinians need to stop being violent. Because when you look at the history, the Palestinians really aren't doing anything differently than anyone else would in their situation. They're defending themselves and their families.
One thing I seem to run into all the time, either, you know, talking to some of the guests who criticize the extreme right-wing Israel political leaders, or if there's any Jewish Americans or Israelis, you know, the non-Jews are immediately branded as anti-Semitic, and if you're a Jewish American or Israeli, you're a self-hating Jew if you go against the main thrust of what the sort of right-wing government is pushing. And U.S. Congress seems to be totally cowed by the Israeli lobby. I forget what the exact issue was, but I remember just in the last couple of months, wasn't there a 99-0 vote in the Senate in support of Israel? I guess one guy was missing, but the whole Senate, from extreme right-wingers to war hawks to Bernie Sanders to Elizabeth Warren, all on the same page. Can you talk about the Israel lobby a little bit? And I don't know if you have any personal sense of this or not, but, you know, I have no firsthand experience and nothing documented, but I've seen some things a couple of times that give me a sense that even in Israel, the media and the press offer more diversity of information and opinion than the corporate media in the United States.
Yeah, Tom, absolutely. The way that the media, portrays this is that, you know, anyone that's not Jewish that speaks about Israeli policies is anti-Semitic, because you have to support Israel because it's a Jewish homeland. And to not do so would mean that you are against Jewish people. In fact, there are a lot of Jewish people working on this issue, working for peace in Israel-Palestine. There's groups like Jewish Voice for Peace, which is one of the largest growing Jewish organizations in the country. It's working for a solution for the Israel-Palestine conflict. There are people in Israel on the left that question Israel's policies. And in fact, the Israeli media is actually much more diverse when it comes to covering Israel-Palestine and issues happening over there than even American media is. So there are fantastic journalists, Israeli journalists, that write very frankly about the occupation, write very frankly about, you know, the right-wing Israeli government and how their policies are, you know, becoming very more and more fascist every day. There's Amir Haas, there's Gideon Levy, there's all kinds of great and very dedicated journalists within Israel that question Israel's policies and that very much are dedicated to reporting the facts and talking about what's going on. So it's simply not the case that if you talk about Israel or if you're critical of Israel that you're anti-Semitic, because you're questioning a policy. And we do the same thing with our own government. You know, when the United States government has policies that we disagree with, you know, citizens have the right and the duty to question those policies. And that's kind of the same thing with Israel. Israel is not immune to criticism. People should criticize Israel the same way they would criticize, you know, the United States' policies or the policies of any government that is doing something that's wrong or is doing something that's unjust. And Americans especially need to do this because we're the ones giving Israel $3 billion per year. But, yes, there are Jewish people and there are Israelis that are also very much dedicated to ending the Israeli occupation and dedicated to getting the facts out there to the people. So the anti-Semitism allegations, they're mostly used to silence people from criticizing Israel. They're not usually based in fact. Of course, there are some people that are anti-Semitic and anti-Jewish out there. So, you know, there's racist people and bigoted people all around the world, but those are not the people that are typically being called anti-Semites. Or rather, the term anti-Semite is usually leveraged against someone that is being critical of Israel, but that is not anti-Jewish in any way, shape, or form. So it's more of a silencing mechanism than it is an actual problem. And, of course, anti-Semitism is a real problem. But, like I said, it's mostly used to shut people up. The allegation is mostly used to shut people up. And then, you know, real anti-Semitism ends up sort of being glossed over because the allegations have now been so widely, because the term has been so overused to apply to anyone that criticizes Israel. So the term itself even ends up losing meaning, which is unfortunate. And then you can't even talk about the real issues anymore.
Yeah.
Now, you asked me a question about the Israel lobby.
Yeah.
So the Israel lobby in the U.S., for people that don't know, most people have heard of AIPAC, which is the American Israel Public Affairs Committee. And AIPAC is a lobby group that tries to influence Congress, well, successfully influences Congress to support any laws or any bills when it comes to Israel. They are making sure that both Republicans and Democrats are supporting whatever legislation Israel wants to get through. So they're one of the most powerful lobby groups in the country. But the Israel lobby is not just limited to AIPAC. There are dozens of more organizations that have, you know, enormous budgets that do similar work as APAC. There's organizations that are completely dedicated to portraying the Israeli government in a positive light. There are organizations that send American Jews to Israel to sort of take them on a trip around Israel and build that affinity between American Jews and Israeli Jews. And those, that sort of ties into the right of return, which in Israel, any Jew from around the world can, quote unquote, return to Israel as their homeland and become a citizen there. While at the same time, Palestinians who had lived there for centuries don't have that same right. But the Israel lobby, yeah, there's dozens of organizations that have very large budgets. If Americans Knew tried to do a quick tally to see how much money these organizations had, and we found that there was $1 billion every year being dedicated to these pro-Israel groups. So the resources they have to get what they want in Congress is enormous. It's very difficult to sort of combat the stranglehold that pro-Israel partisans have on the American government. But, you know, like I said before, with the BDS movement and with all the different organizations working on this issue and having people get out there and contact their representatives, we're trying to make a difference in getting Americans to realize what they're supporting when they support Israel.
Just this week, we are seeing Al Jazeera reports about how Israeli intelligence concluded that if I'm getting this right, Iran was not on the verge of creating a nuclear weapon at about exactly the same time as Netanyahu was speaking with a cartoon-looking bomb diagram, you know, almost saying that, you know, they'll have it next week if you don't do something about it. We've got lots of war hawks in the United States that I think if they had their way would have liked to launch war on Iran already. But now these Al Jazeera reports of Israeli intelligence coming up with essentially the same conclusion as the national intelligence estimate in the United States, which is essentially the consensus of all the intelligence agencies in the United States several years ago, concluding that they stopped their nuclear weapons program, I think in 2002, and have not brought it up again. But we keep hearing they're going to have a bomb any minute if we don't get real tough on them. And Israel, which, as you mentioned earlier, does have nuclear weapons, even though, if I understand right, they have never formally acknowledged that they do,
right.
But everybody knows they do. And Israel is in the thick of all this quote-unquote debate. What should Americans know about that?
Great question. The Israeli government has sort of been using Iran as sort of a scare tactic to get Americans to rally around Israel. But in, like you said, in reality, the Iranian government is not creating a nuclear weapon. The facilities they have are used as energy sources, and Americans need to be very wary of being dragged into another war that is not justified and is not based on real intelligence. You know, the potential cost of a war with Iran, both in the human cost and the financial cost, and what it would mean for the position of America around the world would be absolutely devastating. So I think it's really important that people don't believe the hype and pay attention to the reports that are showing that, you know, a lot of this intelligence that alleged that Iran was close to creating a nuclear bomb was false. And Israeli intelligence itself a top secret document has been made public, so that shows that this was not the case. So the journalists that are covering this issue, the journalists that are actually really trying to do the good investigative work, are finding that these claims by the Israeli government and by Netanyahu that Iran is a threat, a nuclear threat, are false. And, yeah, basically, the Israeli Secret Service's own reports show that Iran is not trying to produce nuclear weapons. So what's being put out in the media and what's being put out by Netanyahu are basically, they're trying to drum up support for a war that would be completely unjustified. And Americans have to be very aware of this and be prepared to protest this and not let it get through, because we don't, it would be absolutely, you know, horrifying to have another Iraq or another Afghanistan or another war that didn't need to happen take place because of Israeli pressure.
Katie Escobar, the clock is winding down a bit. We've just got a couple of minutes left. But as mentioned at the top of the show, Katie has been filling in on this conversation for Allison Weir, who has laryngitis and had to skip a speaking engagement earlier this week. But she is scheduled to be in Kansas City next Thursday, March 5th, 7 to 9 p.m., at Tomahawk Ridge Community Center, 11902 Lowell in Overland Park, in an event billed as What Americans Need to Know About Israel, Two Perspectives. And the other perspective, besides Allison Weir's, will be Dr. Anat Maor, who is currently a visiting scholar at Brooklyn College and was a member of Israeli's Knesset for the Meretz Party, 1999 to 2003. So you'll hear some opposing viewpoints, presumably. But Katie Escobar, anything you want to tell us about what you know of Allison Weir's plans and this event?
Sure. Well, Allison is in Kansas City. She'll be the Tomahawk Ridge Community Center March 5th event that you just mentioned. That debate will take place. She'll also be speaking at the Islamic Center of Kansas on Friday evening. There will also be a regional activism conference on Saturday, March 7th, for people that are interested in getting more involved in working for justice in Palestine. So if anyone wants more information on those details, I would encourage them to visit cjme.org. That stands for Citizens for Justice in the Middle East, who we are working with to put on these events. There's more information at their website. They're a fantastic organization that also helped us put up a billboard in the Kansas City area, or in Kansas City, about Aid to Israel, which actually just got some TV coverage the other night, which we're very happy about. But anyone looking to get more involved in any of those events should go to cjme.org. And we're looking forward to working with you. And thanks so much, everyone, for tuning in.
Katie Escobar, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us this morning on Tell Somebody.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Well, that's it. We're out of time. You've been listening to the podcast edition of Tell Somebody, www.tellsomebody.us. Comments or questions, send an email to mail@tellsomebody.us. You can also follow me on Twitter @TellSomebodyNow. The Tell Somebody podcast is produced and distributed by Tell Somebody and may or may not reflect the broadcast of Tell Somebody heard on 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City, streaming around the world at www.kkfi.org. I'll be on 90.1 FM KKFI every Thursday morning at 9, right after Democracy Now! If you haven't heard Tell Somebody before, I hope you'll listen again. Check out the podcast and the broadcast. Click on a tile at www.tellsomebody.us for a link to a past show. If you enjoyed the show and appreciated the information you got from it, please tell somebody about the podcast and the broadcast. Spread the word to your friends and contacts by word of mouth or Facebook or Twitter or email list or any other way you can think of. This is Tom Clammer. I'll see you next Thursday at 9 a.m. on Tell Somebody, or anytime you like, at www.tellsomebody.us.